Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast episode number 83 for Tuesday, January 11th, 2011. So for all of you who's keeping track at home, that is 1-1-1-1-1. My name is Ben Snickoff.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm David O'Brien.
We're still recovering from the holiday, so it's going to be a short podcast this week, or at least we're going to be short on stories. We've only got two. First off, we're going to talk about a California, it's actually two opinions out of California. First of which is a California State Supreme Court opinion that says that incident to your arrest, police are able to search through whatever they'd like on your cell phones. And secondly, we're going to talk about a story out of the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit out of California that says that big music labels cannot send out promotional CDs and then sue you if you try to resell those promotional CDs. So let's dive right into the first story, which is about these cell phone searches. And as I was thinking about this, I remembered a couple of years ago, there was a scholarly article that came to basically the same conclusion as this case did, that because a cell phone is something that you keep on your person, according to at least the federal law on the matter, incident to your arrest, police would have the right to go through and search the contents of your cell phone to essentially, one, make sure that it's not a weapon, and two, to make sure that there's no evidence relevant to the crime on it that could possibly be deleted by the user of the phone between the time when he's put into custody and a time where they'd be able to get a warrant to search the contents of that device. Any initial, you know, kind of knee-jerk reactions from you guys, Dominic or Dave?
Well, I think as a preliminary matter, you pointed out in our email thread that this now has created a split between the California Supreme Court and the Supreme Court for the state of Ohio.
Yes, so this is a decently good case to for the Supreme Court of the United States to grant certiorari for, which would, you know, give those nine justices a chance to review this question and see if either the California court misapplied U.S. constitutional law, or if finally they should tell kind of rein in the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence regarding searches incident to arrest, which has kind of gone off the rails recently.
Well, I guess it seems like they base this ruling on Supreme Court precedent that's kind of technologically out of date, right? Like, back in the day, cell phones could not store as much information as they do now.
Specifically, they based it on a Supreme Court case about a crumpled pack of cigarettes, which says the Supreme...
Right.
And so in that case, a person was arrested. I forget what crime they were arrested for, but the police were doing a pat-down, searching the guy for weapons, found a crumpled cigarette case, didn't think that there were any weapons of any kind in the cigarette case, but opened it and found drugs inside the crumpled cigarette carton. And the Supreme Court said, you know, it's fine to search that because in addition to being concerned about the safety of the officer, we're also concerned about spoliation of evidence, which is, you know, if this person had been locked in a jail cell and he still had that cigarette case, the cigarette carton on him, he could have, you know, crumpled up the cigarettes or taken out the drugs, flushed them down the toilet. And, you know, we don't want criminals to get away with something like that. So the police have a right to search the people for, you know, evidence of crimes that that they've committed.
So correct me if I'm wrong, though. After a person is arrested and they're actually brought into the police station, aren't they then forced to either change clothes or have all of their personal effects gathered and then put into some sort of containment facility within the police station?
Well, once they're in custody, basically, they can be searched. Their clothes and everything that's in custody can be searched without a warrant, even though time has passed after the arrest. But for the purpose of taking evidence, so.
Right. So they can do an inventory search of their belongings. So
yes.
You can do searches for evidence at the time of the arrest or at the time of booking, and you can do it basically going through everything for the purposes of inventory pretty much any time after they've been booked, as long as it's reasonable. But if you don't do a search of the person either at arrest or booking, you cannot do a search incident to arrest some later time just because they're still in custody.
Right. But the incident to arrest searches basically come from the precedent of officer safety, right? Like, or something that is actively occurring with a crime, like,
yeah, the justifications, yeah, are officer safety and spoliation of evidence.
So I think in this case, Yeah, I was gonna say,
Go
in
ahead.
this case, what's really interesting to me is that the defendant was being named as a co-conspirator, and so this was about a drug transaction involving ecstasy, and there were two people apparently in the back seat, and then the driver, who's the defendant in this case. And the drug transaction went on between the people in the back seat. The person in the back seat was, who was actually buying the drugs, was an informant, and he had a wire on. And the police tracked down the car as it was going, and they were listening in wirelessly. They arrested the people in the back and also the person in the front as a co-conspirator. Then, after being brought to the police station, there was an initial interview with the suspect, and then following the interview, where the person denied having any knowledge that there was a transaction going on in the back seat, the officer who had initially made the arrest searched the phone, was able to find a somewhat cryptic message, which I think said the number 6, the number 4, and then the number 80, which, according to the police officer, stood for 6 tabs of ecstasy for $80, and then showed that to the suspect, who was the driver, and then the driver then eventually acknowledged that he was aware that there was a drug transaction going on in the back seat and that he had taken some part in it. Does that sound about right?
Yes, it does. Right. One thing that I'd like to touch upon is Dominic mentioned earlier that the rulings, I mean, I can't remember the exact year of the ruling, the crumpled cigarette carton ruling, but it's a decently old case. As Dominic mentioned, it's technologically out of date. It deals with a crumpled cigarette carton. It doesn't deal with a phone. I mean, if you looked on my phone, you could find a good number of emails, you could find contacts, appointments, probably years or more worth of text messages. There's just a whole lot of information on there that would be absolutely no way relevant to, you know, a crime that I was being charged with. I mean, sure, some of that evidence may be relevant, but you do have, you know, this treasure trove of evidence that, of possible other crimes that, you know, are totally unrelated to the crime I was charged with. So you gotta wonder, is there a breaking point at some point here where a court other than the California Supreme Court, obviously, because they're not willing to draw a line, but, you know, where a court would draw a line saying, you know, you can't just go through a phone, and, you know, my case with 32 gigabytes of memory on it, just searching, hoping that you find something.
Yeah, the case is actually that you're those the Robinson and the Edwards case. The e-cigarette thing, I think, is Robinson from 1973. Edwards was 1974. The Edwards case was basically clothing with paint chips. But the dissent actually argues the point that you're kind of making, and that I agree with, that basically a cell phone is not a crumpled cigarette package, and it's not just clothing. It contains so much more than that would be. Like, it just entire life could be pretty much spelled out on your phone, and potentially, if you're an accomplished criminal, all sorts of crimes that have nothing to do with what you've been arrested for could be well documented there, as you post on, I don't know, whatever site criminals use instead of Facebook, or maybe they use Facebook, I don't know, have little criminal groups.
It's called Mugshot.
Ah, mugshot.com.
So as I was reading this case, one of the questions that was immediately on my mind before I'd even gotten to the dissent was, what kind of cell phone did this guy have? Was it just a normal cell phone that had a mere capacity to send and receive text messages, or were you talking about a smartphone that has the ability to store large amounts of data on it? And as was not pointed out until the dissent, which appears all the way at the end of the decision, it was never disclosed in the record what kind of cell phone this actually was.
Right, and in this case, they were, sorry to interrupt, Dominic, but in this case, they, you know, were, it seems, just looking at text messages, which, you know, are admittedly relevant to, you know, drug investigation. I'd say text messages and, you know, recent calls, you know, both fairly decent places to look if you're looking for evidence of knowledge of a drug transaction.
You know, what also strikes me about that, though, is that there was an informant that was involved in this case, and he was in the back seat. So just on the assumptions that you can draw from the facts, it would seem that he was the person who had received that initial text message, which indicated 6 tabs of ecstasy for $80. So there would seemingly be 2 records then of the text message, one on the driver's phone and then one on the informant in the back seat's phone. So there would have been another way to get this evidence in, right?
Also one on the cell phone provider itself, because if you have Verizon or AT&T or any major cell phone provider, they log all the text messages for many years. They're required to do so, and that can be obtained with a warrant by law enforcement. What's interesting to me, I guess, is whether the dissent is. I mean, like we said, we don't know what type of cell phone this is. Let's say it's sort of a dumb phone that can just text and receive messages. Does that subject to more or less protection than, say, an iPhone 4? I mean, like, do we want to sort of. Like, my worry is that by setting some sort of arbitrary standard between technological levels of cell phones, we'll encourage criminals to try to bypass that by using a particularly just smart enough but not too smart phone.
Yeah, the other risk is, and I need to thank my law school for making me think like this. Unintended class divisions that you may or may not create with this, where lower income people may not have access to smartphones that, by the mere fact that they contain more information, get more protection. You see the same thing with regard to the curtilage of a home. So police cannot enter the area surrounding your home. Like they could not, lie down on the ground right next to your house and, try to look through the window of your what's the thing I'm thinking of? Look through the like your basement window, with a flashlight to try to see if they can see anything because, they're violating a reasonable expectation of privacy that you have there. Meanwhile, people who live in apartments don't have that protection because, they don't have a curtilage of their home. It's the same kind of, accidental class division that you're creating if you make a new rule for smartphones that doesn't apply to, dumb phones or feature phones.
I'll play devil's advocate with that just for fun. And that's what you're talking about, or what you're describing, are the classical exceptions to the warrantless search laws. So the Fourth Amendment rights protects you insofar as your personal property and things. Otherwise, a police officer would need to get a warrant. And one of the exceptions that everyone's aware of course, is the in plain sight doctrine. And then there's also this one, which is the search is incident to arrest. And I might point out that it's a search that's going on incident to arrest. And in order to be a constitutional arrest, the police officer needs to have some form of a valid probable cause. So, and I think you can argue there that the police officer is already arresting this guy for something bad. If you find out based on a search that's going on pursuant to that arrest, that why shouldn't we be able to charge him with more bad things that he's been doing that he might have had records of on his phone?
Because the Fourth Amendment is kind of meant to protect people from, being able to just go through people's private property willy-nilly in effort to find crimes that they're guilty of.
I mean, the argument the defendant in this case tried to make is the cell phone isn't on their person. Like, it's not like a cigarette pack against your pocket. It's something that you usually carry in a bag or a purse, or I mean, I guess for most, I mean, maybe perhaps attached to a belt on a cell phone carrier, but or even in your pocket. But the pocket one is the one he didn't want to argue. So he's arguing that basically it's not on your person. It's not part of your person. It's more like a briefcase, perhaps, that you're carrying along. And as long as the police make sure that the briefcase isn't going to kill them or injure them in any way, they don't have a right to search the briefcase, because it's not part of you.
Well, generally, you can, I believe, even under this particular exception, you can search things that are within the wingspan of the suspect, and it sort of has to be within their immediate control, and that's what the court focused on. So, it would, of course, depend on the individual circumstances of other cases that involve briefcases, but I think what they were trying to argue is that a cell phone is not necessarily always within your immediate control because sometimes it's
Right.
tucked away in your luggage, which is in the back trunk of your car. Sometimes it's plugged into a wall, charging back up, or sitting on your desk. So just because of its very nature doesn't make it a personal item.
There's sort of two axes, though. There's not just location, there's also time. I mean, yes, it might be in a bag or next to you, but if they search it immediately after you're arrested, then that's very close to the incident of arrest. That makes more sense. But what happened in this case is they sort of searched it. Or they didn't just sort of search it, they searched it an hour and a half after the arrest, when it was well removed from the defendant's person. Basically, unless the guy has some sort of mobile me connection, he couldn't really delete all his text messages from there. There was nothing, and I think it's more analogous to the Chadwick case, which is basically the next in the line of evidence cases. And what happened there is federal narcotics agents saw a guy load a 200-pound double-locked footlocker into the trunk of his car. They were like, this probably has drugs in this. So they arrested him, and then 90 minutes passed by, and they're like, oh, we should probably look inside. And lo and behold, there was marijuana inside. But
Yeah, that
the
was
court
also a
in that
double
case,
locked. Sorry,
yes.
that was also a double locked foot locker in the trunk of a car, which is, in its own way different. Which,
Well, of
if you
course.
were done with that thought, it leads to another interesting question. What if you have, a lock on your cell phone?
Or
You know, I.
security on your cell phone, yeah.
Yeah. At the very least, it gives you time to stall. So interestingly, and I didn't realize this. This may be a new feature on iOS 4. You can toggle something that if somebody inputs the wrong code 10 times, yeah, it'll wipe the data on your iPhone.
Yeah, I've heard that high school kids deliberately input the wrong data on each other's phones to wipe each other's phones.
That's just mean.
I mean, it makes sense, right? Like, it's just a completely unforeseeable, or, well, not unforeseeable, but an unexpected emergent behavior.
So I guess getting back to the case, there's one other point that sort of hurts the rationale of the majority's opinion in this, and that's after they had arrested the suspect driver, they and obtained the cell phone. They still could have obtained a warrant at that point to go ahead and search the cell phone, and maybe it would have been prudent to do that so they could avoid, this challenge.
Yeah, from my experience, I don't think police officers spend a lot of time thinking about what's the best constitutional choice, but yes, it would have been a good idea to get a search warrant for the cell phone. Well, it should
Isn't there
just be a
some sort
matter of
of
training.
part of law that says that if they assume they're operating underneath the under constitutional rights, then they get some sort of exemption or have a better chance to? I seem to remember something like that.
Yeah, so it depends. So if you're If you there's a warrant that you have reason to believe is valid and you execute the warrant but the warrant is invalid under federal law and in some states the subsequent search will be okay because the police officers were acting pursuant to what they thought was a valid warrant. Same with if there's some sort of statute that enables you to do a search. If you believe that the statute is correct, that the statute is constitutional. Any search that you do pursuant to the statute that you believe is constitutional is okay, even if the statute is unconstitutional. That is until a statute gets invalidated, like we saw happen with the Stored Communications Act recently.
So I think this is kind of an interesting result. Certainly interesting now that there's a split between California and Ohio. So Ben, do you remember the facts at all of the Ohio case so we could just contrast that quickly with this one?
Not really. I read it at the very beginning of the week, and sorry to say I did not freshen up on that. My understanding was that it was in many ways a similar case, though, where it was a search of a cell phone incident to arrest, and Ohio came to the opposite conclusion. I don't remember the details of the why they came to the opposite conclusion, though.
It was based on officer
Who's
safety, I think. They said that it
Yeah,
wasn't
so
really directly implicating officer safety at the time of the arrest, so
I can give you a
therefore.
really quick recap of the facts if you want. Basically, what happened is, again, drug-related charges. Okay, so the guy who was arrested received a call on a cell phone that had been placed on his person. In other words, some guy using crack cocaine put this cell phone on his person. Except for the guy using crack cocaine was actually a police informant. So the cell phone actually belongs to the police. They searched this guy and found the cell phone, and then put the cell phone, and the officer put the cell phone in his own pocket, and then they found cocaine at the scene, and then later they searched his phone, the one that the officer presumably gave him and that he had been using for a while, or that the crack cocaine user slash informant had been using, and had given him, and that the guy had been using it for a while, and they found all the phone calls and everything. But the point basically is that, as David said, it's not a officer safety thing because the cell phone was no threat. The guy put it in his pocket.
So the other thing I think that court so at the trial level, first of all, the prosecutors wanted to get not only the call records that they had gotten on that person's phone, but also photographs which had been stored on the phone. And the trial court said no on the photographs, but okay, we'll let you bring in the call records that you discovered on the phone, and that ended up being the basis of the appeal. So it's kind of interesting to see how the authorities in that case actually did try to use other information that they found on the phone, you know, in favor of the case against the defendant.
I guess the money line of the opinion is, because the search of the cell phone's contents was not conducted out of concern for the officer's safety or to preserve evidence, the court found that it did not fall under the search incident to arrest exception, and that officers should have obtained a warrant to conduct the search. And whereas the California case seems to argue that, sure, it wasn't incident to arrest and it wasn't to officer safety, but it was part of the inventorying process, right?
I think that sounds right, although I don't remember a point in the decision in the California case where they pointed out that it was the cell phone had been taken on as a matter of inventorying all the items on the suspect. It seemed to, I like looked at the sentence which described the way that the cell phone had actually been obtained, and it might have been the case that the officer who had done the arrest had originally found the phone, and it was at least it seemed like it had been noted in the record that the person had the phone, the officer was aware of it, and then upon going back to the station and putting the suspect in custody, that's when the phone sort of popped out and was searched after the initial interview. Anyway, so does anyone have any other thoughts on this before we move on?
I'm all set.
Or predictions at the Supreme Court level, for that matter?
I'm going to hold any predictions until somebody actually files for cert, or until cert is actually granted.
Fair enough. So our next case is a Ninth Circuit opinion called UMG versus Augusto. Universal Music Group, or UMG, the huge music publisher, is one of the big four music companies in the world, sued the defendant, Augusto, just an average individual who acquires and sells promotional CDs on eBay. Just like all music companies, UMG distributes specially produced promotional CDs to a large group of individuals, which include sort of music critics, journalists, and radio programmers. These CDs are generally used to promote the content in advance of the official release dates so that the content can receive favorable reviews, press coverage, and that sort of stuff from those people. The actual appearance of these CDs physically is pretty plain from what I understand. It does not have the same markings, text, and graphics that would normally appear on a copy of the work when it's officially released to the public. Although there isn't any real contract that was distributed with the CDs, in this case, the CDs occasionally contain what's known as a promotional statement. And in this case, there were two forms of this statement that appeared on the eight CDs which were sold on eBay. The first of which is a little bit longer. It's, "This CD is the property of the record company as licensed to the intended recipient for personal use. Acceptance of the CD shall constitute an agreement to comply with the terms of the license. Resale or transfer of possession is not allowed and may be punishable under federal and state laws." And the other phrase was much shorter, just says promotional use only, not for sale. So getting back to the defendant, Augusto, he was never one of the intended recipients of these CDs. He wasn't a journalist, he wasn't someone working at a radio station. Instead, he had acquired them through what I presume to be legal means, and had successfully sold them on eBay, and as I mentioned, there were eight of them. And in the eBay descriptions, he was describing them as rare industry editions or simply promo CDs. And after UMG was unable to get eBay to take down those auctions through their dispute resolution service, they sued on the basis of copyright infringement. So, some interesting things going on with respect to the copyright arguments. I'm going to summarize some of them quickly here. Augusto, the defendant, initially had argued that the first sale doctrine would apply and thus limit the rights of the copyright owners, protect the right to distribution, and also that the, and this is a new one to us, I don't think we've ever discussed this on the show, the merchandise statute within the Postal Reorganization Act of 1970 applies to the CDs and allows the recipients, the original recipients of the CDs, to retain, use, discard, or dispose of the CDs in any manner they see fit, including by selling the CDs to thrift shops, which I think is the way that Augusto had originally gotten them. And of course, to the contrary, UMG argued that the promo CDs had a license explicitly printed on the front of the CDs that effectively caused UMG to retain ownership, while licensing the CD to the recipients for the limited uses and restricting the uses of the CDs by the recipients. So, we got a couple things to talk about here, but first, does anyone want to give a rundown on what the first sale doctrine is?
If you sell a copyrighted work to somebody and it's not a license but an actual sale, you lose your copyright over that work and you cannot enforce it against other people after that.
Well, you lose your right to...
Right, so you lose the distribution right,
again,
essentially,
yeah,
for that particular copy of the work.
Yes, so but they can't just freely copy it. They can resell it, though, without your permission.
Right, so it's one of the classic limitations that's actually embodied in the Copyright Act, kind of in the same area of the Act that the Fair Use Doctrine is, but in a separate provision. This is Section 109A. And it reads that notwithstanding the exclusive rights held by a copyright owner, the owner of a particular copy or phono record lawfully made under the Copyright Act or any person authorized by that lawful owner is entitled to sell or otherwise dispose of the possession of that copy or phono record. So, as we know, you know, software can constitute copyrightable subject matter, and we all click through user license agreements or EULAs and other restrictive contract agreements, which basically tell us that what we're receiving is we don't actually own, we are just merely licensing the use of it, subject to certain conditions. How would you describe this circumstance being different than that?
Well, I mean, I think several key points to note are that they send out these CDs to people without necessarily getting those people's permission. There's no license agreement being set up. They're just being mailed out. They didn't track who received them. They didn't track where they went. They just kind of assumed that people wouldn't sell them because it said not for resale or the longer text that you cited.
Yeah, but, you know, we agree to shrink wrap licenses all the time. And when I go to a, you know, retail outlet and buy a copy of, you know, Delicious Library, Will Shipley, the guy who makes Delicious Library, has no idea who I am. He has no idea, no way to track who he's selling that to. Yet, you know, there's a shrink wrap license either in the software or, you know, on the box itself that when I open it and when I install it, I agree to certain conditions. How is the shrink wrap license on the promo CDs any different?
So, interestingly, a little historical fact here about shrink wrap agreements. When they first started appearing, there used to be a notice on the outside of the box that said, if the sale of this item is subject to certain terms and conditions contained within. And after you took off the shrink wrap and pulled out the product and were able to view the license agreement either on a paper or on the software or the media itself, which contained the software, then you would see clauses within there that said after removing the shrink wrap of this, you have agreed to the following terms. Not that much different from this case, I think, because the CD itself is marked. In one case, it has a couple quick sentences which seem to constitute a basic license, and in the other case it says this is a promo CD, not for resale. Obviously specifically implementing or trying to get at the first sale limitation within the Copyright Act. The court, however, disagreed with UMG's arguments, and they awarded the case, or they agreed with the district court's disposition of the case to Augusto. And this is kind of interesting, I guess, because this comes after another case that we heard in the early fall, which was Werner v. Autodesk, which was another first sale doctrine case. And that case left a lot of people questioning what really was left of the first sale doctrine, because it dealt with user license agreements and software. And the argument kind of boils down to, for some people out there, that just because a person calls a license agreement a license, does that mean that you don't actually own the copy of it, and that they can control all uses of it after it's already been given to you, or after you've already purchased the software and the license that goes with it. So I guess one other interesting thing that the court seemed to hinge on in this case was this provision of the Postal Reorganization Act, and it reads that, and I had not really been familiar with this before, it reads that for unordered merchandise, the mailing of unordered merchandise constitutes an unlawful or an unfair method of competition and an unfair trade practice. If such merchandise is received by way of an unordered shipment, the person shall have the right to retain, use, and dispose of it as he or she wishes. So the court seemed to hinge the case a little bit on that particular provision, noting that if it's unlawful to send unordered items directly to people, you basically can't have a contract that deals with the subject matter on those unordered items.
Well, basically UMG's argument here was it's not a sale. so the first sale doctrine doesn't apply because we just sent them for them to these guys for free, so we didn't sell it to them. So no first sale doctrine because there's no sale. And the court used the Postal Service Reorganization Act to basically say, well, no, because you're not supposed to send it like this anyway, and because you did, you lost all rights.
But they did go on to make the explicit finding that it was a sale within the, well, at least a transfer of ownership of a copy for
Yes.
sale purposes.
That particular provision of the Postal Reorganization Act rendered then the recipients the owners then of the copy because it then constitutes some sort of gift. And once they dispose of it to the next person, in this case that it was whoever had received the copies initially, then the title that just carries then with the CD itself. It's not subject to even the license restrictions which were on it. But curious to me is that if that particular provision had not been in place, or if there had been other factual circumstances that might have applied to the distribution of these promo CDs to the original recipients, I'm not sure that it would have been unordered merchandise if they had like called ahead of time and let them know that these things were coming, and maybe if they had sent a written contract or also given some sort of notice that the promotional CD shouldn't be given to anybody else or disposed of in any way, I don't know that it stops the license agreement from taking effect, because otherwise it would seemingly be a valid license agreement. Do you guys agree?
If the original recipients had ordered the discs.
Been aware of it in some way. So if I'm UMG and Dominic, you are a famous DJ, let's say you're DJ Rabier. What if I call you up and just let you know, like, hey, Dominic, I've got these great new hot hits here. I want to send them over to you. These are, of course, promotional CDs, and they will be governed by our traditional, promotional license restrictions. I'm going to send a digital copy to you via email, also with the terms of the license agreement attached to them in some way, whether that comes in an email or whatever. I send that to you. You have then some awareness that there's a license agreement that pertains to these CDs, and I guess might be different if it's email versus postal mail, where you might be able to send back over the postal service the items that you have received. Maybe you can't do that in email. Do you think, though, that in those circumstances the license restrictions would still apply?
I guess in the first circumstance where you've sent it to me email and supposedly you've wrapped it in DRMs, then yes, the license will restrictions will apply because they're enforced by software. In the second case where you've sent me basically a snail mail package, and let's say I open it and it says, before opening this package, please agree to this license, and there's a shrink wrap license of that variety, then I think it would apply there as well. But both facts are not really like what we have here.
No, they're not, and I guess my only point here is pointing out that this particular decision might be factually limited as far as it, enforces the first sale doctrine. So it looks like a win, but I don't know that it's as big of a win for the first sale doctrine as people might have hoped for.
I think that's fair. Any last thoughts on these before we wrap up, guys?
All set here.
I think we're good.
Okay, in that case, I would like to thank you all for listening to this, the 83rd Technically Legal Podcast. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at TechLegal or head over to our website, www.technicallylegal.org. Send us comments, suggestions, story ideas to podcast@technicallylegal.org. Signing off, I'm Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening. Have a good night.